This is Jeff Chrisman, and I'm here today on the Living Arts of Tulsa podcast, and I'm very glad to have the opportunity to be visiting with educator and artist, Dr. Delia Gillis. Dr. Gillis, thanks so much for taking the time with me today. I appreciate this.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What I'd like to do, if I could, and I have several things that I would love to have the opportunity to ask you and to learn more about you, but I thought just to start the conversation, if I could ask you just in your own words, what your work, as far as your work in education, as well as your artwork and your creativity, just what those things mean to you at a deeper level.
Well, I think it really shows the complement of being a whole person, a whole human being that grows throughout life, throughout this journey, and really coming, you know, full circle in your experience. I am an educator. I'm a professor of history and Africana studies, but for well over a quarter century now, I've had an opportunity to have interconnected activities in the art world. I don't necessarily see myself as an artist so much as a creative. I've had a lot of experience with museums and archives and curation. And I think just in this leg of my life, in this season of my life and my professional career, I'm doing more artistic and creative work. And so the opportunity to bring an exhibit to Living Arts Tulsa as a part of the centennial celebration just seemed like a really great opportunity to pull together some things and people that I've worked with over the years to participate in a very meaningful way. And I've been very intentional about that. Even though I am a historian, I did not want to be a carpetbagger and come to Tulsa and just jump in the fray, because I think there are a lot of great people that have been doing the work and now is their time. But I did want to, as a scholar and a historian, have my own contribution to what is an extremely historical event, and the fact that the forces that may be led me to have the opportunity to live and be in Tulsa and bear witness to this historic moment.
Oh, thank you so much, and really honor that. And I was going to say that it's very tempting. I could see myself just diving right in and wanting to ask you questions about your involvement with this upcoming exhibit. And however, at the same time, though, I do want to also take the time to really to get to know you, and also to understand your history as well. So what sure. I thought I would do, if it's okay with you, is maybe talk to you a little bit about you first, sure. as an educator and as a creative person, and then also talk, on the, I guess more of the second half, just about your work and your contributions to this exhibit, if that's okay with you.
Sounds wonderful. Well, I am a bohemian spirit. In fact, one of my dear long-term friends, who's an aunt to my adult children, likened me to a butterfly. So I love to travel. I was born in rural Virginia. I am a 10th generation American. I can trace a line of my family to 1619. And that English ancestry line, we can also trace back to the 1400s on the English Channel Islands. So I take great pride in recent years of asserting myself in that way. It goes back to about 2007, 2008, when I start to think about my experience in that way. But I grew up in rural Virginia, where they grow tobacco. In fact, my high school, Bluestone High School, is situated, or at least at that time was situated, in between tobacco fields. And we took a bus about 30 minutes to drive out, further into the rural countryside to go to high school, for example. I'm the oldest of five children, and my father is deceased. In fact, he passed 16 years ago to the date. An artisan, a brick mason, and my mother was a reading teacher. And I come from a family of educators. On my paternal side, my paternal aunts are educators. I have a cousin who's an educator. In fact, I have an 80-year-old aunt who retired from two different school districts. One of my great, great one of my great grandparents, which I didn't know. In fact, he lived to be 106 years old, was able to acquire property and farm and educate all of his children. They went to a historically Black college called St. Paul's College, which does not exist at this time. And another piece that I've been able to do in my family research is learning that a structure that's set on my family's property that, you know, I would pass by and play as a child was actually a school as a part of the Rosenwald Foundation. So it was a Rosenwald school. And my great grandparents ceded land at the edge of their property for that school. So education just runs just really naturally deep in my family. But as a teenager, I left rural Virginia and I traveled and went to school primarily in Europe on the military bases. I was a Air Force family member. And so that's where my love of travel started. I skipped a grade and graduated from high school at 16 and just kind of began to see the world. So that's a little bit about my upbringing as a youth. A lot of things that I think come into play in who I am as a person and in my profession has to do with growing up very grounded in rural America and growing up in a home where I was always surrounded by grandparents or great grandparents and always being able to know like four generations of my family at any particular given time. And so I think there is just kind of this history or this appreciation of the past and traditions that was just innately a part of who my of who I was, or definitely something that my soul really gravitated to growing up. And so I started out in business. I actually was in banking and my undergraduate degree is in business, but I relocated to the Midwest in 1990 to the Kansas City area and went on to do graduate and doctoral work. I earned my PhD at the University of Missouri and switched from business to history because that was really my passion. So I think my high school history teacher would be very proud of me, you know, that I did really well. I remember in high school, I petitioned to skip home ec. I wanted to take world history and government, world history and world geography, but they denied my request. They said I could not have both classes, that I had to take home ec. And so that was, you know, in the 1980s, late 1970s, where the girls would take home ec and the guys would take shop. I didn't want to take shop. I didn't want to take home ec. I knew how to cook. I baked with my grandmother. I wanted to take geography and history. So I think that was just a sign of what was to come later in my life, that I would end up being a historian.
Yes. And I was going to ask as well, thank you so much for sharing that. It would be very interesting just to hear, you know, as you started formally teaching, just anything that you might share in terms of what that was like as you got started, and then anything that you might share just about, you know, anything you can see in your own personal evolution, you know, as a result of what you have shared with students over the years.
Sure. Well, actually, that's how I made the transition. As I said, I was in banking. I worked with American Express for several years. I worked at every level, whether it was a credit union, community bank, savings and loan. And I made the transition because I ended up training, and I really love training and teaching. And so when I decided to go back to graduate school, the university that I was attending, where I teach now, the University of Central Missouri, the MBA program was not accredited. And I was not willing to go into an MBA program that at that time was not accredited. And so I looked at becoming a certified teacher, and I looked at getting the history master's. And the history master's just seemed to be the better program. For me, it was the least amount of hours. So I started my teaching at the community college level, teaching there. And I think what was so significant about that specific experience was that I was teaching students that were going to school to become mechanics or nurses, vocational positions. And so for me, I felt like as a teacher, I wanted to be able to reach any student. I would love if everyone became a historian like myself, but that's not realistic. What I wanted to leave my students with was an appreciation, at least, of history, and to continue to have an inquiring mind. So I think that was probably the most significant experience in my early career about what it meant for me to be not only a historian and scholar writing about the topic, but in my classroom. And now, gosh, almost, you know, to a quarter of a century later, what has remained a part of the way that I teach is to bring history to life to them, whether it is through the relationships with their family and community and neighbors, or whether it's in place. It's always been about engaging my students in their surroundings, because so often, not only national history, but local history is just really not very well known. And I have used that, you know, if you will, as the carrot to get them engaged, because so often students walk into a history class, and I don't care if they are high school, fresh out of high school, or whether they're returning adult, you know, they just have certain connotations about history that closes them off to studying. And mainly it's just memorizing dates and names with no meaning. And so what I have spent my life's work is trying to bridge that gap, to take that out of the equation and to make it valuable to them.
And then I was going to ask as well, I didn't know if there were any formative experiences in terms of seeing students, maybe kind of seeing that light bulb come on, or maybe seeing, you know, them looking at their own heritage and their own history, you know, in a deeper way.
It's everything. It is everything. It's really what makes the work that I do so wonderful. When I first was teaching on faculty at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, I started using Kansas City as an incubator because it was new to me too. While I had been trained by some of the best minds at the University of Missouri, and I knew the African American experience globally, there were so many things that were going on in Kansas City's history that should be in the textbooks. And so that was really where part of that started, where I would have students write their papers not only on a national figure, but a local figure, so that they could make that connection between, you know, making change and making positive impacts on their community. It's very easy for us to point the finger at a president or a civil rights leader and think that's the end all be all. But really, history from a social perspective, from looking at social and cultural history, is really looking at everyday people and how we make changes and how we impact the world. And so those were, that was a really important piece. And in fact, I'm teaching my class on African-American women this summer, and that has always been the case. I've been teaching that course since 1994, and I always have them write about local women and not just national figures. It's not that they don't deserve to be covered, but I wanted to make sure that my students are familiar with people in their community and in their region.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I really honor that. I just, you know, that is definitely something that, you know, it sounds something that really is very, I would imagine, would be very nourishing for students, and to be able to have a different, for them to have a different perspective. So it's definitely something that I definitely have a lot of respect for. And I was going to ask you as well, just hearing a little bit about just your creative side. It would be very interesting, you know, just to hear a little bit about maybe how you got started, you know, in creative endeavors with art. And, you know, if there is any, I don't want to assume anything, but if there is any relationship between that and your educational work.
Sure. I will answer that question, but I want to give you a really good example. In one of my classes, my students wrote about the founder of the Black Archives of Mid-America, the late Horace Peterson. And I had the opportunity to speak to Mr. Peterson before his swimming accident when I was working on my master's degree. And I just remember he said, well, when you get done, bring it to the archives. And not 3 weeks later, I see in the Kansas City newspaper that he passed. And that was just really, you know, as a historian, you know, you want your sources to remain. And the fact that he passed and he'd asked me to deposit my thesis at his archive, and I did. And several years later, I had the opportunity to serve for 8 years on the board of the Black Archives. And so in this particular class, I was having students write about local people. And one of my students selected Mr. Peterson. And what turned out, she selected him. But what was equally compelling was she worked with his son and she didn't even know it. She did not know that until she on the project. And then she had the opportunity to do an informal interview with his son. So I just thought that that was just really a great example that popped into my mind when you were saying, you know, just how this works and how it impacts the students. So it's just really meaningful, just instead of looking at books or encyclopedias or what have you to write about someone, this student out of their curiosity had picked this person and ended up, you know, having that conversation with the gentleman's son. How did I get into art? You know, sometimes, you know, I'm a person of faith. And so, you know, God directs that path. And so I very reluctantly, if you will, got into art. And that goes back to my upbringing. It's so interesting that you asked the questions about formative, because my mommy was a taskmaster. I love her, but she was very clear that she pushed us in what we did well. And if you did not do it well, she did not allow you to pursue it. And so my artistic musical side is not the best. As a child, my punishment was not being allowed to go to the library. And that was treasonous to me. Like, what do you mean I can't go to the library? Well, that's what mattered to me. but she did not allow me really to participate in musical endeavors because both my parents played in the band. And I thought she said, no, Didi, you don't have talent. You won't be doing that. You know, so I was a cheerleader. I was a majorette. So I kind of shied away from the arts. But when I took my position at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, there was a huge exhibit on the artist Henry Oswald Tanner. And I was invited to give the lecture to the educators. And so that began my career in art. And over time, I have just had the opportunity to serve on theses or dissertation committees where the person is working in art or theater or music, but they needed someone with the African-American or African content, and that would be me. And so it forced me to grow and learn and become more involved. And so in my career, I've just had the opportunity to work with students in that area to provide them the content. I worked several years on different programming projects with the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. I have served for, I think about 15 years now on an educational board in Kansas City. And so that's how I've kind of reluctantly come into the arts. And so now at this juncture, since I'm based in Tulsa, I want to spend more time with curation. I've actually had images selected for a centennial project with the YWCA. So my photographs will be on display. Yeah, I have five photographs that have been selected for the resilience exhibit with the Tulsa YWCA, which makes a lot of sense because my first book is a book of photography. I curated a book of over 200 images about African Americans in Kansas City in Arcadia Publishing Black America series. So those are just some of the ways that, in addition to just being a university professor, I became involved in art primarily as a content expert or for programming and speaking and panels, do a lot of things with film. I teach with film. I'm currently teaching a class right now on the legacy of Chadwick Boseman, the late Chadwick Boseman of Black Panther fame. I've had the opportunity to sit on panels with filmmaker Kevin Wilmot, for example. And so it's just been a part of my experience. It's just that in Tulsa, I've decided, instead of it being happenstance or opportunities or requests being brought to me, I'm now seeking them to kind of increase and grow and get to do things that I want to do that, you know, maybe I couldn't do as a kid because it wasn't my best skill.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you shared that. Thank you. And that to me is very inspiring. I really appreciate that. Yeah. And then I was going to ask as well, just kind of transitioning, you know, from that theme into the current, or not the current exhibit, but the upcoming exhibit that will be opening, I believe, next week at Living Arts. It would be very interesting just to hear, you know, how your involvement came about with that, and just any reflections that you might have, at least up to this point, you know, what that has been like for you.
Right. Well, as I said, you know, as a historian of the African-American experience, being in Tulsa at this time is a humbling honor. And I've taken it very seriously and been very intentional about my contribution. And one of those contributions had been creating an entire class on African-American Tulsa for my students, which I taught in the fall of 2020. And so COVID obviously ruined some best laid plans. I'd wanted my students to come down and visit and participate in a walking tour with me, et cetera. We weren't able to do that, but we were able to do a few things through Zoom and video cast. And one of those had to do with public meetings around the mass grave. So my students were actually in class when all of the controversy over the Black Lives mural existed. They were in class when it was taken away. And then shortly thereafter, we find the marked graves. And obviously that work is ongoing, unmarked graves. And so that work is ongoing. And so my students were able to, again, bear witness to history in a way that we often struggle with in our history courses to make relevant, because students often do not feel like this isn't relevant. What does it have to do with me? This was very real for them. And again, yeah. we were able to see it in real time. And one of the things that struck me about the class, and it didn't matter what the topic was, it didn't matter what we were working on. I had them looking at images. I had them looking at oral history interviews of survivors. Obviously they were aware of the public hearings and were watched some of those online. Every single discussion, students said, I never knew this. No one ever taught me. My teacher never told me. And it was so very, really heavy on me, because I've continued to hear that in the community. I was on an Art Deco tour of downtown. And the gentleman who did that talk said, you know, I'm from the area, maybe in the 80s. I was out on a Black town tour the other month, and some of those residents also didn't know. So in the entire year that I've been in Tulsa, in almost any forum, people said, like, I really didn't know. Now I have to say, now I knew, I've taught, you know, about Tulsa, because in teaching African-American history, we teach about the Red Summer of 1919 and these different periods of unrest. So I was aware of it, but not necessarily to the depth. And so this, I didn't know, and my teacher didn't tell me, stuck with me. And so when I saw the invitation to submit, I wanted to do something around the talk. And that's why I reached out to a dear friend and someone who really had drawn me into the art world with different panels and gallery talks and discussions that I mentioned, was Sunny Joy Ruffin, who is a nationally acclaimed fabric textile artist. And so again, things work out. Actually, Sunny and I were on the phone talking about a different project when she had mentioned that she had a distant relative that she believed had perished. And so that was in the back of my mind. I saw this proposal. I really wanted to do it. I said, let me reach out to Sunny and see if she would just lend me anything. Will she please just lend me anything from her collection? And she agreed to do so. Hmm. And so that's how the exhibit was born, that using her work as a backdrop to give voice to what I wanted to share and what my students shared about not knowing and why it's important to tell that story, because suppression is really at the depths of it. And what is very heartbreaking, difficult at this moment is that, and it's complicated with the layers of we're commemorating this and we have to move forward. But what is clear to me is that we cannot move forward until we are really honest and more open and transparent about what happened and repairing that. And so I can only say to this extent, to respect the family's wishes, is that in this process, we learned that it was not a distant cousin. It was someone much more closer in the Thompson family. And oh, so it was not something that even my artist knew, and that by me approaching her and we doing this project, that she learned even more. And so at that, and that's about all I would say to respect the family's wishes, that what happened in 1921, though it was 100 years ago, still impacts us today. And I think we are remiss if we think that just because the survivors are gone, that it does not still impact us, because trauma was done, harm was done, and it impacted people in the region. Because another piece that I'm working on with a reporter in Kansas City that I've worked with over the years, again, what I wanted to offer to this historic moment was the connections between Kansas City and Tulsa. There are a lot of connections between Kansas City and Tulsa that'll be coming out in a news article in May. But some of those included the fact that some of those families relocated to the community of Kansas City, Kansas, to start new lives. Another local person that I work with, who is the curator of a historic school, that's the story of her family. She has legions of family members that graduated from Booker T. High School in the 30s. And actually, I don't want to misspeak, but it's either the father or grandfather actually moved here to Tulsa from Texas to help in the rebuilding process. So
interesting, yeah.
So the fact that this is going on in living arts means everything, because for me, it's the opportunity to combine living arts and people seeing history as living and not static. And that these events have impacted not just the community at that particular moment, but a variety of communities over time. And it's still impacting people today. And so we can't say that it's over and it was 100 years ago and it didn't matter. It does matter.
I am so glad you shared that. And I was going to say, I am so deeply moved by just everything that you've shared. And that last statement is, it speaks volumes about about how important it is in terms of, any healing that happens moving forward.
Right, we can't really have the healing. Yeah, it's like putting a Band-Aid over a wound that needed stitches. It's not going to heal, it's going to fester. And so I think, from that perspective, we had started out with one piece in the exhibit, which was perfect. But she switched to another piece. And I think that really speaks to, yes, we want reconciliation, but reconciliation will not come, redemption will not come, unless we address what really has happened, with a level of honesty and empathy. It's not about judgment. It's not about pointing fingers. It's about really understanding the layers of what happened and how that's reverberated over time.
I'm so appreciative, because I feel like even for myself, this has been a learning experience to understand. And I don't know if I'm saying this right. I'm just really paraphrasing what I'm hearing from you, that how much history and people availing themselves of it, and people like yourself who are educating people about the history and the relationship to healing and reconciliation. I never really thought about the the relationship, unless I, and I'm open to being wrong if I'm not seeing it in the way that you've explained it, but I really do, I'm sensing the connection there.
Well, and what I always talk about, because again, because I've had these different roles of not just being the scholar that's writing the written word, but the preservation of. And I always tell my audiences, I can only teach. We can only teach about what we know about. So if people have collections that are destroyed, or, you know, when family members pass away, you put it in the trash, you know, those are nuggets that we don't have to work from. And that was one reason why in the Tulsa course, I made sure that they were exposed to all different types of sources to think about, whether it was the photographs, and then I had them to find where that particular location was. Like, there's a Home Depot that's located where survivors were interned. The fact that the OSU Tulsa sign actually sits on the same property where a physician was murdered in the massacre, so that they could see, they could see that. But one of the pieces that's coming out, because we're doing the art, the education, and the history, is the suppression of this trauma. And what has happened, it's been suppressed for some, it was purposely suppressed so that the wrongdoers were never held accountable at that time. But it's also been suppressed by the families and their descendants as a trauma. So not unlike what we speak about in terms of certain traumas that exist from enslavement. We know about the traumas. There have been so many studies around the traumas of Holocaust victims, and how even if, you know, you were a Holocaust survivor and you had a child 20 years later, that child still suffered from that trauma. And so because of the ways in which the parent, the survivor, you know, parented them and raised them and socialized them, that trauma is carried on. And so today I have to bear witness that that trauma still exists. And it was uncovered, you know, very unintentionally toward a project. But so I know that now, without a doubt. And so I have to speak on that to at least that extent, that we have to think about the suppression. That's why no one knows. That's why, whether it's a college student, a professional, a retired person, it didn't matter over this past year when I've been in all these different venues, you know, people, black, white, pink or purple, young to old, I didn't know. No one told me. We have to speak on that.
I really do deeply honor that. Thank you. I'm so glad that you've shared all of this. And I was going to ask as well, and there again, I don't know if there is, you know, I don't want to assume that there has been any kind of connection or any effect in how you know, in terms of your perspective, but I was wondering just, you know, what it has been like for you, you know, being here in Tulsa, and then if in some ways, if there has been any shift in perspective, or, you know, whether it's you know, very minute or something that's, you know, a major shift, just in terms of your perspective about what happened then, and just anything that in terms of how that's being experienced currently.
Well, I would have to say that I've had a lovely time here in Tulsa. I relocated as a part of the Tulsa Remote Program. Tulsa as a community was not unfamiliar to me. My youngest child's grandmother is from the area. So I have visited Tulsa on, you know, many occasions. I think that there is what we would say a critical mass. I think there's a critical mass here in Tulsa that really does want to understand what happened. And I think the activities that will take place over the next few months, over the summer, the national attention that Tulsa will receive are all important steps. And so I think it just will be incumbent upon this leadership, whether it's, you know, political leadership, community leaders, educators, and just inform citizens in general that where we go from here. Because now this is Tulsa's moment in 2021. So Tulsa, the city, made certain decisions in 1921. We can't go back and undo that. But it's 2021, and we have a great understanding of what has happened. Great books done on the topic. Scott Ellsworth, Hannibal Johnson, Mr. Moreno has a new book, The Victory of Greenwood. So the work is there. So no one can say that they don't know or can't find out if they want to. But once you know, what are you going to do with that knowledge? And so that's the eyes are on Tulsa now, that we have an opportunity to do it right, if you will, to respond to the moment. And so I'm just prayerful and hopeful that it will be one in which we honor, because part of Tulsa really sits on sacred ground where life has been lost and not had the opportunity to be mourned. And so culturally, for some cultures, that's more important to some cultures than others perhaps. But you know, that's what we're asking at this point. I think that's what helps to lead toward the healing.
Thank you so much. I must say that I honor your work and your contributions to this remembering, and not only here in Tulsa, but throughout your career, it's something that certainly speaks to me. It speaks volumes. It speaks very loudly to me. And I really do honor all of this. And I really appreciate you taking the time to visit with me today to share all of this. I'm very appreciative.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. Thank you.